Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Halbrooks, Judge Larkin, Judge Smith, the Honorable Jill Glasscamp-Halbrooks presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. On behalf of the panel, welcome to the Court of Appeals this third day of January, 2019. You know, I will tell you of interest, I was reminded by our court administrator that beginning this week, we will be posting arguments online. And so, although we've always recorded them, they will now be posted as Supreme Court arguments are. So sometime, perhaps within 24 hours or more, our entire calendar, including your argument this morning, will be posted online. Just a new feature of our court. So, Marshall, could you please call our first case?
The first case is A18-0472, Haley Elizabeth Steele Davercow, a minor, by and through her parents and natural guardians, John Davercow and Bernadette Steele, respondent, versus Ann Raymond, formerly known as Ann Hummel, respondent, American Family Mutual Insurance Company, and Lady Mayor Appellant.
Thank you. Counsel, you're familiar with our rules. You'll be able to monitor your length of argument by the light on the podium, and feel free to adjust the height if you would like to. So, counsel for appellant, please begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Darwin Williams, and I'm here on behalf of American Family Insurance. I also have a cold, so.
We understand.
The issue before the court in this matter is twofold. First, American Family should have been allowed to intervene as a matter of right under Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 24.01. And second, whether the court's order approving the settlement agreement between Ms. Davercow and Ms. Reamer, expressly as a Miller-Shugart agreement, was reversible error when the appellant was barred from presenting argument at the hearing because it was not a party. Rule 24.01 allows for the right of intervention under a four-part test that's subject to a de novo review and is to be independently assessed by the Court of Appeals. The spirit behind Rule 24 is to encourage all legitimate interventions and thus requires a liberal application. That's in Engelrup, the Engelrup case. And absent sham or frivolity, the court is to accept the allegations in the application for intervention as true. That's in the Costley versus Kerriman House case. Before I get to each of the four parts of the test, I just want to stress that the reason that American Family wants to intervene in this matter is because it views the settlement agreement between Ms. Davercow and Ms. Reamer to be a hybrid of something in between a Miller-Shugart and a Drake-Ryan agreement.
So, counsel, I just wanted to ask you that. Is that, if it were indisputably a Miller-Shugart agreement, you wouldn't be making this argument, is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so it's a fact that you think it's not?
Correct.
Okay, thanks.
Although that issue isn't really before the court because that issue hasn't yet been heard from the district court level.
We were not allowed. But isn't that an issue you could still raise at the district court level?
If we were allowed to intervene, we would ask that we be put back in the position of the hearing on approving the agreement, the settlement agreement, and we could then make that argument to the district court.
But couldn't you do that even if you hadn't intervened by just bringing a deck action to challenge the reasonableness of the settlement agreement after the district court's adoption or approval of the agreement?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
This is deja vu. Were you the appellate lawyer at the first appeal?
Yes,
I feel
was.
And I was on that panel, and I feel like we had this very conversation about, okay, at what point does someone need to decide what type of agreement this is? We heard your concerns, and I think there was sort of a general discussion, well, of another side, almost a concession. Well, of course they can raise that issue later. That's why they shouldn't intervene now.
And the question becomes, at what point does the appellant make that argument?
Okay.
I don't know what point that would be made. So we'd like to make it at the district court level at this point.
Would there be any harm to you if you're, or your client, if you're allowed to make that argument in a deck action challenging the reasonableness of the agreement?
Well, there could be harm, Your Honor. In the district court's order, dated February 14th of 2018, the district court found some facts that I don't know if they would be applicable to that other hearing that we're proposing, but...
Okay.
But there are some...
Go to coverage? Facts as to whether or not she was visiting her cousins, that type of thing, Mr. Williams?
Correct, Your Honor. Yeah. So if that order was left to stand, and that specific finding of fact has nothing to do with whether or not we should have been able to intervene, if that finding of fact were to be held in a separate hearing as applicable, that would have an effect.
So my recollection from the first time I saw this case was that you were simply trying to preserve for American Family its right to challenge the reasonableness of the settlement, including what type of settlement it is and whether it was a proper Miller-Shugart, and that seems to be what you're again asking for today, to make sure you don't lose that opportunity.
Yes, Your Honor.
Got it. Thank you.
So at its core, the case today is about an applicant for intervention's basic desire to be heard by the district court on an issue that mattered enough for it to file an application for intervention, and important enough that we've been before this court twice in order to try to get our voice heard. The four-part test for intervention starts with a timely application. And while it's true that this case began way back in May of 2012 when this dog bite occurred, it's also true that the settlement agreement that is at issue in this case and the words in the settlement agreement actually was not fully executed until January 24th of 2016. It was then in August of 2016 that we brought an order, or we brought a TRO to block the neutral evaluation that we had been noticed was about to occur. And it's in an August 2016 order denying a temporary injunction in which the court found as a fact that the petitioner, which was American Family, may participate, and if petitioner elects not to participate, they should seek review to challenge the reasonableness of any such award after the coverage issue is determined. So the court that issued this other order is the same court that issued the dissolving of the TRO, and in its finding of facts said that we would be given an opportunity to challenge the reasonableness later. How we do that after the court has already determined the judgment and that it is already a Miller-Shugart agreement, which is what the basic order now states, how we challenge whether it's a Miller-Shugart or a Drake-Ryan later, I don't know how that can occur without being in violation of the initial order.
But just for my own clarity, and relating back to earlier questions from Judge Larkin, I mean, if this is characterized as a Miller-Shugart agreement, you agree with that. Is that correct, Mr. Williams?
I agree that that would be the correct process if it is determined to be a Miller-Shugart.
Okay.
What I disagree with is that this is actually a pure Miller-Shugart, that it's instead some kind of hybrid.
Even though it's entitled that on the agreement, and the district court refers to it with that characterization.
You're right, Your Honor. That is what they titled it, and that is how the court referred to it from the beginning.
And if it were a Drake Ryan, what's the implication of that, that there is no reasonableness defense in a later DEC action?
If it were a Drake Ryan, there's a different procedure that this case would go through in the future. We currently do have a DEC action pending in the U.S. federal court. And that's, there's no summary judgment hearing yet scheduled. But my understanding is that the discovery deadline is, and the dispositive motion deadline are March 10th. And so summary judgment action motion, cross motions for summary judgment are going to be heard
discovery
sometime thereafter.
Is proceeding in that case.
Correct. So, back to the timeliness of the application, if I may.
Can you tell us, based on case law, what triggers the beginning of the timeliness determination?
Well, I would say that because this argument is based on the wording of the agreement, that the trigger would be when the agreement was entered into. And the agreement was entered into on January 24th of 2016. That's the last date in which the last signator signed the agreement.
And what authority do you use to conclude that date is the appropriate one?
I have no authority other than I would just say it's common sense that with the argument being that the agreement itself is what is in question, then it can't, American Family couldn't have made that argument before it was executed.
Okay.
So, in November of 2016, November 14th, the district court noticed a hearing for December 16th of 2016 on the entry of the agreement and entry of judgment on the agreement. Within 20 days exactly, on December 1st, American Family e-filed and e-served its application for intervention, and I admit that I made a technical error in not including a separate notice of intervention, and that's been an ongoing issue between Mr. Holland and myself for a while here. But the e-filing and the e-service made that a harmless error, and there's no doubt that Mr. Holland was noticed based on his immediate actions afterwards and his timely filing of an opposition to the intervention 30 days late, within 30 days. It was actually at the 30th day. In Pyle National Company versus Amos, the Seventh Circuit indicated that Federal Rule 24, which is the same rule as the state Rule 24, should be construed liberally, and that technicality should not be invoked to defeat intervention. That exact wording about technicalities not being invoked to defeat intervention is cited in a Minnesota decision, Supreme Court decision, Engelrup.
Just because you're getting short on time, Mr. Williams, you've directed us to the four factors for intervention for the de novo review. Could we return to those and specifically factor three? Can you speak to how you satisfy that factor, the circumstances demonstrating that the disposition may impair or impede the party's ability to protect an interest?
Sure. So a Miller-Shugart agreement goes through a different court process than a Drake-Ryan agreement. And I don't want to get into a lot of the technicalities, but one type admits liability, the other type continues on its path to trial. And the primary insurer in a Drake-Ryan tenders the defense then to the excess insurer, which hasn't happened in this case. As a practical matter, the way in which the approval of a settlement agreement is interpreted by the courts matters more to American Family than it does to Ms. Reamer, because in paragraphs 6 and 13 of the agreement, those are on A7, A8, A11, and A12, Ms. Reamer is protected from personal liability regardless of whether it's a Miller-Shugart or a Drake-Ryan agreement. So even if the court enforces the agreement, even if the court doesn't enforce the agreement, she's protected under the paragraph 13 on page A11. And I think that's evidenced by Ms. Reamer's decline to even appear at the hearing that we were having on the approval of the agreement. So because American Family could be impeded in its deck action based on the language of the order, that's one reason that we would be impaired or impeded. It's also an issue that we've already discussed, whether or not American Family is going to have a right at some point to dispute the reasonableness of the judgment award, the amount. From the very beginning in the application, we indicated to the court that I appeared for the neutral evaluation, which in the actual settlement agreement isn't called a neutral evaluation. It was agreed that they would have a binding arbitration, not a neutral evaluation. But I appeared for the neutral evaluation to observe, and there were issues that I expressed in my application for intervention that I wanted to speak to the court about and their decision as to what the judgment award amount was going to be.
And why do you think that you will be impaired in doing that later, challenging the reasonableness?
Because I don't know at what point we're going to be able to decide that we can challenge the reasonableness when the court has already found in its order that the agreement is reasonable. So it appears that the district court overstepped, and instead of just approving the settlement agreement without getting into details of what kind of settlement agreement it was, approving the judgment without deciding that it was already reasonable, those are the issues that we have with it.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Your time has expired, but you will have up to 5 minutes for rebuttal should you choose to use it.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. Good morning. Grim Howland for Haley Dauber Co. Intervention is a methodology that's used to permit someone who's outside of the litigation with no other recourse to protect rights to become a party in the existing litigation. It is not a method to be used to turn back the clock and get a redo or a course correction for an insurer that had every opportunity to protect the rights it now seeks to protect and take the legal actions that it could have taken all along since May of 2012 to now disrupt a settlement agreement. And one thing that I think the court should note is that intervention, as I said, is a method to get an outsider to become a party to a case. In Minnesota, a liability insurer is never a party to the case. And so if this case were to have started, as this case started, American Family never would have been a defendant in this case. What American Family is trying to do is undo a settlement agreement that's made pursuant to the Supreme Court's rights established for an abandoned insured under Miller v. Shugart and get a bite at talking about liability, jury trial on damages, and a discussion, as we've heard here, about the nature of the agreement.
I mean, certainly they could not be a direct defendant here, but it is not in the least uncommon to make a motion to intervene when things reach this stage and the parties are talking about Miller-Shugart. I mean, often there is a defense being offered with a reservation, but you would agree, would you not, that a motion to intervene is an appropriate step for an insurance company?
In this Miller-Shugart process, Your
yes.
Honor? No, I would not agree with that. The appellant hasn't cited a single case that has shown that an insurer can intervene in the Miller-Shugart process. I cited a case, Hartfield v. Allison, which is unreported, I believe, but that's distinct from this case in that there was a contemplated Miller in that case. It was unexecuted. There was already a reservation of rights. There was a defense being put on. And when the plaintiff just unilaterally tried to enforce a Miller-Shugart agreement that hadn't even been executed, then there was an intervention by the insurer saying, wait, we want to protect our rights here. And there, this court found that that was appropriate. But there's not a single case that I have found or that defendant has cited where intervention at the time when there is an executed Miller-Shugart agreement, when the insurer hasn't taken a single step to protect its insureds or protect the interests that it purports to have, where that's been permitted.
So the motion may have been brought, but it would have been denied, is what you're saying.
The motion for intervention? Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, as it was denied. And the district court laid out all of the four factors and concluded that not a single one of the factors had been met. The case was not timely.
Well, could we focus on that just initially? It seems, I mean, as I asked Mr. Williams, what triggers that assessment? Is it when the action is filed?
I don't think so. I think you look to the Supreme Court case of SST versus Minneapolis, and that's the case where it was the construction of the city center, and there was some litigation about the destruction of the Forum cafeteria. In that case, the Supreme Court started talking about factors of notice to the purported intervener that were years before the purported settlement or the attempt to consummate the settlement. And the factors that they looked at were the media coverage, the call by the city council for comment and public input on the city center. They went back many, many years. In fact, I think it was 4 years, just like in our case, before the actual litigation commenced and the actual settlement was attempted to be consummated.
But if unquestionably, as you argue, there would be no opportunity to intervene on a Miller-Shugart, why wouldn't it be triggered at the point that the insurer believes that it's not a Miller-Shugart? In other words, if it really was a Miller-Shugart agreement, they would never have, in your argument, right, an opportunity
right.
to intervene. So why should notice go so early if at that point there was no agreement to even debate?
Sure, for two reasons. One, because intervention isn't intended to be a situation where someone sits on their rights and does nothing. And although here today Mr. Williams has suggested that the only thing that they're interested in is whether it's a Miller versus a Drake, both at the court below and in their materials submitted to this court, they have suggested that they have the entitlement to a jury trial on both liability and damages. And so those are issues that go all the way back to May of 2012. If you're talking about triggering at the date that the agreement is signed, we're still looking at a year before any attempt at intervention or any attempt at a DEC action was made. As if we take Mr. Williams's date of January 23rd, 2016, no attempted intervention was made until November or December of that year. So there, if you use the analysis in SST or in any of the other cases, when the litigation is at a conclusion, when there are no other facts to go into, if the intervener tries to come in and inject new facts into a case, it is, as the Supreme Court said in SST, too little and too late.
If we were to affirm, would there be an opportunity to challenge, for the insurer to challenge whether this is a Miller-Shugart or a Drake, or would they be limited only to a reasonableness defense on a Miller-Shugart? Or even that, is that available to them?
Well, I don't think, if you look at another case, coincidentally also called Hartfile, this one is Hartfile v. McLennan, that's a published appellate court case. They've said, the panel there said that the insurer does not have a right to question the reasonableness of the argument during the Miller-Shugart process or after the Miller-Shugart process.
What do you mean of the argument? Can you be more specific? I cannot challenge the reasonableness of the argument, you said.
Oh, I may have just misspoke.
Okay.
Cannot
challenge
of the agreement.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. The court in Hartfield v. McLennan essentially said that the analysis is limited to whether there's coverage. When an insurer denies coverage and abandons its insured and the insured uses the Miller-Shugart process to protect herself. As Amika said, the insured puts its eggs all in the basket of the coverage. And Hartfield v. McLennan endorsed that idea and said that they don't get an opportunity to discuss the reasonableness of the agreement.
And that was a Miller-Shugart.
That was a Miller-Shugart. In terms of, to Judge Smith, to answer your question a little more fully, in terms of is there another opportunity, typically in the declaratory judgment action, there is raised as a defense of whether it's reasonable. And there is a declaratory judgment action going on. And while I didn't review the pleadings before I came here this morning, I assume that they raised that defense as well.
So part of my question, I think, if I recall, is in that action, right, where one would challenge typically a reasonableness of a Miller-Shugart, is it available to challenge also whether, in fact, is a Miller-Shugart? I mean, when can that actually be raised then? Are you just saying it can't be, and that's the risk that they ran?
I don't think that it can be raised, Your Honor, because pursuant to the Brownsdale case, the insurer gives up the complete control and conduct of the litigation. And the key issue is there a denial of insurance coverage? If there's a denial of insurance coverage, then the insurer can only argue about whether there is coverage, not whether what the nature of the argument is, or the nature of the agreement is. There, I did it again.
Okay, so if this were, if we posit a situation where unquestionably it was not Miller-Shugart, but it was a Drake Ryan, it gets mislabeled as Miller-Shugart, et cetera, the insurer has no right, or should not, in fact, be able to intervene, and there's no opportunity in another action to challenge that. They're stuck with that.
They're stuck with it, but there's a protection in the Miller-Shugart process. The protection is, I think of the Miller-Shugart process as very similar to a petition for minor settlement. The court has a duty as a public body to determine the reasonableness of a Miller-Shugart agreement, just like it has the duty to protect the interests of the minor child from...
You're talking about the court who's approving the settlement.
Correct. Correct. And as the body of law for Miller-Shugart has developed, there are a number of factors. They're called the Jorgensen factors, and the Jorgensen case is surely cited by me. It is to ensure that the agreement is reasonable, to ensure that it's not the product of fraud or collusion, and the judge uses a number of factors to consider whether this kind of an agreement is reasonable. So there is, in fact, a protection for an abandoning insured built right into the Miller-Shugart process of ensuring that a situation that American Family is complaining about here is addressed. And
I was talking about if in fact it was mislabeled as that, and it really is a Drake Ryan, like everyone agrees it is. Why don't you tell me actually what happens if something's labeled Drake Ryan and it is a Drake Ryan? What's the process then? And what would the insurer's options be at the district court?
If it were labeled a Drake Ryan and everyone knew it was a Drake Ryan, mm-hmm. we wouldn't be here because it would be a completely different kind of posture. And
why? What would the insurer have done? Move to intervene?
And the insurer granted? Doesn't have to move to intervene because okay. in a Drake Ryan, the first level of coverage is paid or some amount thereof. And liability up to the first level of coverage is admitted, but defenses as to liability and damages are reserved mm-hmm. for the secondary policy. And so you'd just be back to litigating the secondary policy just like you would in any other personal injury case.
So it has a very, it has a big impact which one it is, obviously, in the rest of the case, in the remainder of the case. And
sure.
So I guess the question is just, when there's an allegation that it's, or a claim that it's one versus the other, I mean, the impact is big as to which one it is, but I think your argument is as long as it's appears to be or is labeled a Miller-Shugart, I'm just not exactly sure what's, sure. you know, in the idea where there is an alleged hybrid, what's supposed to happen then?
The allegation of a hybrid is just not consistent with the actions taken by the parties to the underlying action.
Okay, that's your position, but what court decides that and when?
I think that that is decided by the operation of what steps the parties take, okay, how the parties address it.
And if there's a disagreement regarding the steps and the results, where is that litigated and when is it decided?
I think that it would have to be decided in the declaratory judgment action and not
what declaratory in judgment action?
Well, there's currently a pending one.
Okay.
Right, right. And in the, so assuming that there's...
So you're saying appellant still has the opportunity in the pending declaratory judgment action to argue and have a court determination regarding what type of settlement this was?
I think it can be raised as a defense in the declaratory judgment action. I think that...
But how does... Appellant is the plaintiff in the DEC action. How do they raise it as a defense?
Appellant is not the plaintiff in the DEC action, Your Honor. That's, we commenced that.
You commenced
against
it.
Appellant, okay, in the district court.
Seeking what relief?
Seeking a finding that there is coverage under the policy and that there is, American Family is liable to pay the judgment that was entered against its insured up to the available limits of coverage.
Can I just ask you to clarify one thing? I want to make sure I understood you correctly. You cited a case of this court for the proposition that the insurer does not have the right or the ability to challenge the reasonableness of a Miller-Schuchert settlement.
Yes.
Okay. Isn't there an abundance of case law stating the opposite, that the reasonableness is one of the things that can be challenged? In addition to coverage, reasonableness, and absence of fraud and collusion, isn't that what the Miller case itself says?
That the reasonableness is evaluated by the court as the case law has developed. So the court discusses what the reasonableness factors,
okay,
are.
And does the insurance company get to have a say in whether or not it's reasonable?
Typically not, Your Honor. And it's typically... The Hartfail v. McLennan.
What's the year of that case?
I believe that is 91, Your Honor.
And what's the year of Miller, if you know?
Miller is in the mid-80s, Your Honor.
Okay.
82. Hartfail, according to your brief, is 98.
Thank you.
That is correct. Thank you, Your Honor.
So, as Judge Larkin, in her direction, I mean, you're arguing that this court basically overruled or in some way clarified Miller, a Supreme Court case, to say that the insurer loses that opportunity to challenge reasonableness in a DEC action or a garnishment action subsequent to a Miller-Schuchert?
You know, I don't think that the court was attempting to overrule Miller. I think the court was setting out the parameters of what is available to an insurer following the entrance of a Miller-Schuchert agreement. And I think that the parameters are limited to whether there's coverage under the policy. The court has an independent duty to evaluate the reasonableness.
Right, but you're talking totally in the context of in the approval of the settlement.
Correct, yes. Mm-hmm. I don't think that under the circumstances that an insurer that has waived its rights to participate should be permitted to have a superior right to have those interests protected at a later date. And that's one of the key elements of Miller, is that Miller undertook a balancing act of the rights and responsibilities of the parties when there's insurance coverage in dispute. And they found that it's better for the insurer, better to prejudice the insurer, or that insurer runs the risk, because that is the party that made the determination that there was no coverage. So I think the court in Miller, quite frankly, says it's an unenviable position for the insurer. But that's the risk that's borne to the insurer. And the law of Miller is that when an insurer declines coverage, refuses to provide a defense, then it takes the risk that it will be prejudiced by a later agreement, and it loses the opportunity to comment on that agreement as long as the district court is performing the function of evaluating it for those Jorgensen factors,
so
the reasonableness.
The injured party has to bring, you know, you get your agreement, and I don't have a background in insurance law, so just walk me through this. Injured party gets their agreement, the insured or is not a party to that agreement, can't participate. Once the agreement is in hand, it's enforceable as to the parties, but not against the insurer. So the injured party has to go to court and seek a deck action saying there's coverage, this is reasonable, the insurer has to pay. And your position is, yes, the court has to make those determinations. And even though the insurer is a defendant in that action, they don't get to be heard on those issues in the action.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Based on Hartfield.
Based on Miller, Hartfield, Jorgensen, the whole body of cases that has developed over the 35 or so years since Miller.
How is the court to make those determinations based on a one-sided presentation?
Great question. So that's one of the reasons that in Miller, the party simply stipulated to a damages amount double the policy limit. And Miller said, that's fine. Even though it's more than they could ever recover from the insurer, they said, that's fine. As the law has developed, parties have found it helpful to do an evaluation by either submitting just written materials or having a presentation to a lawyer that's experienced in personal injury to provide some expert guidance for the court. But among the Jorgensen factors for reasonableness, the court is to rely on what its own experience is with jury verdicts and settlements regarding the nature of, or regarding those kinds of injuries. It's also to rely on its own experience on what a defendant is likely to settle for under the circumstances. It doesn't have to be what is a defendant certainly going to be liable to pay, but what would a defendant, the person in the defendant's shoes, potentially be liable for?
Presiding Judge, may I ask another question? I know we're out of time here, but
I'm sorry. I didn't realize how over we were. Almost 5 minutes over. Yes.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So Jorgensen was in a garnishment that arose in a garnishment action. Is that right?
It was a Miller-Shugart agreement, and then garnishment and deck action. Yes.
Yes. Okay. And then and in that garnishment / deck action, the reasonableness was evaluated.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. So the reasonableness can be evaluated in the later action, but your argument is that the insurer, who's a party to that action, has no. I'm not quite following. I mean, if it can be evaluated, what's that other party doing in that action if it doesn't get to participate?
It participates in the coverage action, Your Honor. It's participating in. in whether there's coverage at all. I think an important thing.
So you're just saying there, and otherwise they have to be mute in that later action about the issue that the court is rightly evaluating, which is reasonableness.
Yeah, I think that's true. And that
I'm going to cut you off because I have, but one quick thing. In this case, we have no analysis by the district court as to reasonableness. We have a blanket statement saying it is reasonable, but none of those factors you were talking about, like, you know, risks at trial or other. Verdicts or that type of thing. I mean, we have nothing, correct?
So I'll be honest. I don't recall what the order was on the reasonableness. I don't recall whether Judge Anderson laid out the factors. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
And if he did not, what do we have to review on that? Or is that even
before
us?
Well, it's not before the court.
Okay.
And it's not before the court today. And as I mentioned in the brief, the question of whether it was error for Judge Anderson to exclude argument on that is not properly before the court.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
My apologies for not keeping an eye on the clock. It was a compelling argument. We were listening to both sides. Yeah. Rebuttal, Mr. Williams?
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple of issues. One thing that I'd like to point out in the Miller case, Miller was decided after the deck action had already found coverage. That's, I think, an important distinction of Miller. And to be clear about American Family's intent here, we are not trying to undo the core settlement agreement. We certainly want Ms. Reamer to be protected from personal liability, in exchange for Riverport's payment. Riverport was the daycare provider, and they paid their policy limits. We're an excess carrier, and one of the things I wanted to point out to the court, in case it wasn't clear in the record, in the appeal record doc index 53, that's where the motion for intervention, my affidavit is, and it includes exhibits. The certified policy is in that exhibit, and under conditions section 2 on page 12 of 18, there is a clear statement in the policy that for coverage D, which is the personal liability coverage, the American Family policy is an excess provider. This becomes important once we get to whether this is a Drake Ryan or Miller Shugart, which really isn't before the court today, because excess layers of coverage are an important distinction, but Mr. Holland is right. That's not the issue before the court today. The issue is whether American Family gets a chance to intervene so that it can make those arguments at the district court level.
If this court were to hold that intervention was properly denied, does that prevent you from bringing your own deck action in district court or to challenge the reasonableness or raising it as a defense in federal court?
The barrier for us to bring our own deck action was actually under the Servicemen's Act, and plaintiffs not wanting to avail themselves to the Minnesota courts until they decided they were ready to bring their own DAC action. So the way that it ended up working was we have a cross motion in the DAC action in the federal courts at this time, and there'll be cross motions for summary judgment.
And you'll be raising the reasonableness issue there or attempting to, regardless of what happens here?
Well, Mr. Holland has just said to the court that they think that we should be moot on that, and that those issues shouldn't be heard, that the court will decide reasonableness on its own without any input from us.
Is that issue even before us?
No.
I mean, it does seem like that's their end game, but I don't know if that's an issue that's been raised and decided in the court below.
No, only in that it becomes important as to whether or not we should be allowed to intervene, because those issues could be determined if we're allowed to intervene.
So one of the factors in the intervention analysis is whether you'd be precluded from raising this issue elsewhere. So if we were to say, well, respondent is correct, you can't raise reasonableness at this point, intervention was your only opportunity, then that could factor into the intervention decision. Although respondent's position seems to be you can never challenge the reasonableness because you didn't defend in the first place.
That is their position. So in conclusion, what American Family is asking this court to do is twofold. We respectfully ask the court to grant it the right to intervene because this is a de novo review of the intervention motion. So that can be determined at this level now. And in being allowed to intervene, of course, that would be meaningless if the court orders from January 6th of 2017 and February 14th of 2018 weren't vacated and remanded back so that we could be heard at that hearing on those issues.
One question, Mr. Williams, in the concluding seconds here, and maybe my colleagues have others, but in the motion that was brought for settlement approval in this matter, did respondent ask the district court to find reasonableness of the settlement amount?
I believe it did. I couldn't say for sure.
Okay.
I don't have those papers in front of me right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry.
Any further questions? Right. Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. Matter's been submitted.